Welcome back. This episode is written by me. I'll let the introduction play out. Hello again, future doctors. You're tuning into Spoonful of Sugar, the podcast made for and by medical students, where we break down complex topics into bite-sized pieces for your success. I'm your host, Bilal Rana, a third year at Western University, and today we're going to look at easy ways to understand CSF pathology. This is part two of our two-part series. In the first part, we discussed hydrocephalus, and in this episode, we'll be discussing CSF infections. Okay, so when we think about CSF infections, what we're really thinking about is meningitis plus Guillain-Barré, because Guillain-Barré happens to have CSF findings. Now, I guarantee you're going to get questions on this topic. You will find that you may recognize the signs and symptoms of meningitis or Guillain-Barré, but then they hit you with a CSF analysis and they say a lumbar puncture shows XYZ, and you're like, what the heck is going on? It's actually a lot more simple than they make it out to be. And in this episode, hopefully we can, you know, demystify any of the misconceptions or points of confusion that students often have. So let's start by asking, what is meningitis? So meningitis is an inflammation of the meninges. The meninges is a protective layer around the brain and spinal cord, and when that becomes inflamed, it becomes an itis, meningitis. What kind of symptoms would you expect? So you're going to have some non-specific symptoms to start. You know, headache, confusion, nausea, vomiting, fatigue. And then it's going to level up. You'll know when it's a meningitis when you'll see symptoms of fever with neck stiffness, photophobia, seizures. Those are really telltale signs that you might be dealing with a meningitis. In addition to that, there are two, technically three, really high-yield findings on physical exam. Do you know what physical findings I'm referring to? So you have the Koenig sign, Brzezinski sign, and as a bonus, if you're dealing with Neisseria meningitis, then you may also see a petechial rash. So what is a Koenig sign? So a Koenig sign is elicited when the patient is supine, and what happens is you're going to extend the patient's knees while their hips are flexed into 90 degrees. And here's what's going to happen. If there's any resistance or pain elicited while the knee is being extended, this is known as a positive Koenig sign. They won't ask you about Koenig sign as often. They may ask you about Brzezinski sign. So what is Brzezinski sign? So this is when the patient is lying supine, except this time the examiner is going to passively flex the patient's neck. And in doing so, if the patient is involuntarily, and this is the key, involuntarily flexing their knees as a result, then that is a positive Brzezinski sign. I should note, for the purposes of board examinations, I don't recall ever seeing a question where they explicitly say, we elicited a positive Koenig or positive Brzezinski sign. They're probably not going to be that nice. They're going to describe it in a similar fashion that I've described it. So just be aware that understanding what these signs actually are and how they're described is just as important as knowing the name, if not more important. And I also mentioned that if you're specifically dealing with a Neisseria meningitis infection, that you'll have a particular rash. In addition to that, there is also one other infection that can present with a similar rash, and that would be a rickettsial meningitis. And the way you would distinguish a Neisseria meningitis over a rickettsial meningitis is that the rickettsial one will have much less alarming CSF abnormalities, which we'll talk about right now. So now, before we get into the meat of CSF analysis, I just want to mention a disclaimer. This can be a complex topic. I've seen a low percentage of people answering this correctly in UWorld, myself included. So if you're in this boat, don't worry. If you miss these questions here, that's okay. This is the time to miss them. So when you're presented with a CSF fluid, you're going to want to know the following things. First, you're going to need to know the differential diagnoses, and that will include bacterial meningitis, viral meningitis, fungal or tuberculosis meningitis, and You'll see later why I put those together. Herpes encephalitis and Guillain-Barré syndrome. In addition to knowing these differentials, you also want to know the components of the CSF analysis. And this will include the cell count, the cell type, how much glucose is in the CSF, as well as how much protein is in the CSF. So before we actually break down what the different CSF looks like in each of these differentials, I'm going to start by sharing with you some really important rules. I also want to mention that each of these rules has an exception. So the first rule of understanding the CSF is you need to be familiar with the cell type. There are three cell types that you need to be familiar with. Can you recall what those are? So these are going to be your neutrophils, lymphocytes, and erythrocytes. Now these will 99 times out of 100 be given to you. But the few key exceptions here are that in Guillain-Barré syndrome, you're not going to notice any of these cell types. In addition, the other rule you should know is that herpes encephalitis is the only one with erythrocytes. Yes, it also has lymphocytes, but you really don't want to care about that one as much. If you see erythrocytes, you're very likely leaning towards herpes encephalitis. And then the other ones are more self-explanatory. It's basically the kind of things that you would expect on a CBC, for example. So if you expect a bacterial infection, you're going to see more neutrophils. If it's a viral or fungal infection, you're going to see more lymphocytes. For the next rule, we're going to be talking about three things in conjunction: the white blood cell count, glucose, and protein. So all you need to know about these is whether they increase or decrease. Now, just a general question. If you have an infection, what would you expect for the white blood cell count? It's going to be elevated, almost always. So with the white blood cell count, we really don't have to overthink this. If there's a meningitis, it's going to be elevated. But like I said, with each of these rules, there is an exception. The exception here, Guillain-Barré. Of course it's Guillain-Barré. And why is that? You don't need to know the exact reason why, actually. But think of Guillain-Barré syndrome as a sequela of an infection, not the infection itself. So since Guillain-Barré syndrome isn't the infection itself, then we would not expect an elevated white blood count. Because again, white blood count is going to be elevated if there is an active infection, which would make sense why Guillain-Barré does not have an elevated white blood count. So the next rule concerns protein. So the rule here is that protein is almost always going to be elevated. Almost always. The one exception is that it can be normal in viral meningitis. And when I say can be normal in viral meningitis, I'm not including herpes here. So that's the only exception. So protein will almost always be up, with the only exception being it can be normal in viral meningitis. It will never be lower. Then the third rule concerns glucose. So this one we'll have to use our thinking caps a little bit. Which one would you expect glucose to be decreased in? Would you expect it to be decreased in a bacterial meningitis or a viral meningitis? So you would expect glucose to be decreased in a bacterial meningitis. Now, why is that? Because bacteria, they thrive on glucose. They need glucose to survive. So if you have bacteria in the CSF, they're going to take up whatever glucose is there, hence a decreased glucose in the CSF. So bacteria need glucose to survive, and you know what else needs glucose to survive? Fungal infections, right? So fungal infections will also have a decreased glucose in the CSF. So those are the only two that will have a decreased glucose. It's going to be normal everywhere else. Viruses don't use glucose. Herpes sure as heck doesn't need glucose. And Guillain-Barré syndrome, again, not an infection. So you're going to have normal glucose. So that was a lot of information. Let's do a quick summary. Three cell types: neutrophils, lymphocytes, and erythrocytes. Neutrophils are found in bacteria. Lymphocytes are found in viral infections as well as fungal infections. And then erythrocytes is specific to herpes encephalitis. Guillain-Barré, because it's not an infection, is not going to have a cell type. Then you have white blood cell count, which will always be elevated wherever there is an infection of going on. Guillain-Barré isn't an infection, is a syndrome, so that's going to be normal. Glucose is only going to be decreased in bacterial or fungal infections because bacteria and fungi require glucose to live. Viruses don't. And again, Guillain-Barré syndrome, no organisms. And then lastly, protein, always elevated, with the only exception being viral meningitis, where it can be normal. Okay, earlier I talked about the signs and symptoms of meningitis, but I didn't talk about Guillain-Barré syndrome and how it occurs. So let's briefly talk about that. What is the pathophysiology behind Guillain-Barré syndrome? So Guillain-Barré syndrome is an immune-mediated polyneuropathy, and it destroys Schwann cells through a process known as molecular mimicry. And what's the cause of Guillain-Barré syndrome that you need to know? So the key thing about Guillain-Barré is that it happens within a week or two following an infection. And what kind of infections do you want to familiarize yourself with? So some high-yield ones are the Campi infection, so Campylobacter jejuni, viral infections, as well as Mycoplasma pneumonia. You only really care about the first two, and I'm not really going to get into the weeds of what type of viral infections because that's a lot more low yield for the purposes of board examinations. And what are the symptoms that you would expect to see in somebody affected with Guillain-Barré? Super, super high yield. You will expect to see symmetric ascending muscular weakness and neuropathy. And when I say ascending, what I'm referring to is that these infections usually start at the feet and then they travel up to the calves and the thighs. And they'll make this pretty clear on the question stem. They'll say something like, oh, 1 week ago, the patient had numbness and tingling in the feet, and suddenly it's a lower extremity weakness, da 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 da. They'll make it very clear that there is a time course with this infection. In case you're curious, there are more symptoms that can be associated with GBS, for example, cranial nerve palsies, autonomic dysfunction, ophthalmoplegia, but these are lower yield, so I wouldn't worry about these. But there is one high yield fact that you need to know about GBS. I'm placing it here as a bonus. It puts you at a risk for what complication? Respiratory failure. So patients afflicted with GBS need to be monitored for respiratory failure. This is something to keep in mind. Now, as far as diagnosis is concerned, there are multiple ways to diagnose these. If you're studying for step two, you need to know those methods, but I won't talk about them here. The one that you want to be familiar with is the lumbar puncture. So using the rules that we talked about earlier, let's see if we can figure out what is in the CSF for GBS. So what cell type would you expect? No cell types. Remember, there are three cell types, but Guillain-Barré, it's not an infection, it's a syndrome, it's a sequela of an infection. So no organisms, no cell type. What about the white blood cell count? It's normal. Again, no infection, no elevated white blood cell count. What about protein? So protein count's going to be elevated. Remember, most everything is going to be elevated. Again, the one exception is viral meningitis, which can be normal. And what about glucose? Also normal. And why is that? No bacteria, no fungi. There's nothing in the CSF that needs glucose to survive. Now, I mentioned something really important here. We have elevated protein, but a normal white blood cell count. This is what test writers really love to focus on. This finding has a specific name. Can you tell me what the name of this finding is? So the name is albuminocytologic dissociation. Let's break down the word. So albumino refers to albumin, and we know that albumin is a protein. Cytologic, referring to cytology, which is the study of cells. And then dissociation, meaning to disconnect. So in this case, there is a disconnect. So there is an elevated protein count, but then there is a normal white blood cell count. If you really stop to think about it, that shouldn't make sense. hence the dissociation. There's a disconnect from what is normal, what you typically expect to see. All right, now we're going to be moving on to practice questions. Again, I have to reiterate, if you get these wrong, that's okay. This is the space to do it. So we have a 19-year-old male college student with nausea, vomiting, and a headache. So for vital signs, we see a temperature of 102.5 degrees Fahrenheit, a blood pressure of 79 over 55, and a heart rate of 144. You do a CSF analysis, and it shows elevated white blood cell count, elevated protein, and many erythrocytes. What is the diagnosis here? So you saw the erythrocytes, so you should be thinking of herpes, encephalitis. I did a few mean things here in this question. Let's go over them. So first question, when you think of a college student with meningitis, what do you typically think of? You typically think of meningococcal meningitis. And the reason I'm asking this question is because step one has increasingly been asking about risk factors, and that seems to be showing up some more now than in years prior. So college student with meningitis typically equals meningococcal meningitis. And usually this is prevented. You don't see as much of this because we get a vaccine for it before we go off to college. And what is the key symptom that you would expect if it was a meningococcal meningitis? A diffuse petechial rash. And can you remind me again why in this question stem it wasn't meningococcal meningitis? The cerebrospinal fluid findings, because in meningococcal meningitis, you would expect elevated neutrophils. We didn't have that. We had elevated erythrocytes. Now, what about glucose? I didn't mention anything about the glucose. See, I intentionally left that out. And I did that on purpose because sometimes the board examiners will do this. They will leave certain pieces of information out because there will be other aspects of the question stem that will reveal the answer for you. In other words, you don't need all the CSF findings to get your answer. The presence of erythrocytes in this case is more than enough and will get you the answer right the majority of the time. But while we're here, we might as well ask, if you were to look at a CSF of somebody with herpes encephalitis, what would you expect the glucose to be? You would expect for it to be normal. Why? Because herpes is a virus. Viruses don't need glucose. What about in the case of meningococcal meningitis? Yep, lower. This is a bacterial infection, and so a bacterial infection is going to have lower glucose because they need glucose to survive. Okay, next question. Now you have a 25-year-old female coming in with the exact same symptoms, the nausea, vomiting, headache, and high fever, low blood pressure, tachycardia as well. So let's cut to the chase and talk about the CSF. You see elevated white blood cell count, normal protein, normal glucose, and the lymphocytosis. What is the diagnosis here? So this would be viral meningitis. Recall that viral meningitis is the only one with normal protein. Now, again, I tried to make this clear earlier on, but I want to reiterate again. Viral meningitis sometimes gets confused with herpes encephalitis, since herpes is a family of viruses, but there are two key differences. One of them has to do with the cell type. Can you remember what that difference is? Yeah, we hammered it a lot. Herpes will have erythrocytes. That's the most important fact here. And then what else is different about herpes versus viral meningitis? The protein count. What's different about the protein count? So the protein count in herpes encephalitis is elevated. Remember the rule. Protein almost always elevated in everything. The one exception is viral meningitis, where it can be normal. Okay, we have two more questions. Now we have a 70-year-old male. Same exact symptoms. Again, cutting right to the chase. So your CSF will show an elevated white blood cell count, elevated protein, decreased glucose. My question to you is, what additional finding on the CSF would make this a diagnosis of a fungal or a TB infection? Okay, so we already talked that there's a white blood cell count, a protein, a glucose, but what we didn't mention was the cell type. For this to be a diagnosis of a fungal or TB infection, you would have to see lymphocytosis. Had it been neutrophils, or a presence of neutrophils, that would lead us to a diagnosis of a bacterial meningitis. And let me tell you, for the purposes of step one, if you can just differentiate the type of meningitis by the cell type alone, you can eliminate a lot of possible answer choices. All right, last question. We have a 29-year-old male. Just came from a camping trip, and he's saying he has difficulty moving his feet since 4 days ago. Today, he's presenting to the emergency department with the inability to walk. Okay, you already know this is Guillain-Barré, so let me ask you some other questions. What would you expect to see on the CSF? You would expect to see elevated protein, normal white blood cell count. What about the cell type? You wouldn't see any cell types. Again, there's no organism here. And what would you expect to see about glucose? Normal glucose. Again, no organism that's eating up glucose. Not a single glucose scavenger in sight. And what is that term again for elevated protein and normal white blood cell count? What do we call that? Albuminocytologic dissociation. Next question. What is the most likely infectious etiology of this patient's symptoms? Campylobacter jejuni. This is the most likely. Quick facts about Campy while we're here. It's a comma or S-shaped gram-negative rod, oxidase positive with polar flagella, transmitted via the fecal-oral route, usually also due to undercooked poultry or unpasteurized milk, and the key symptoms that you can look out for are watery or bloody diarrhea. Other infectious etiologies can include viral infections and mycoplasma pneumonia, but again, you're probably not going to see mycoplasma pneumonia a lot, more likely a viral infection. Okay, you made it through that headache of an episode. Let's do a quick review of everything. So meningitis is an inflammation of the meninges, which is the protective layer around the brain and the spinal cord. General symptoms you can expect are a headache, confusion, nausea, vomiting, and fatigue, which can crank up to a fever, neck stiffness, photophobia, seizures. On physical exam, you could elicit a Koenig sign, which is when the patient is supine and the hips are 90 degrees flex and you extend the knees and that causes resistance and pain. Or you could see a positive Brzezinski sign, which is more likely to show up on your exam. Patient is supine, you passively flex their neck and their knees involuntarily flex, okay? If you're dealing with a Neisseria meningitis or a rickettsial meningitis, you can also expect to see a petechial rash. Compared to a rickettsial versus Neisseria meningitis, a rickettsial meningitis will have less alarming CSF abnormalities, lower yield, but I figured I'd mention that. Remember the rules. You first want to talk about the cell type, either neutrophils, lymphocytes, or erythrocytes. Guillain-Barré is not going to have any, and herpes is the one with erythrocytes. For white blood cell count, almost always elevated, with one exception, Guillain-Barré, because there's no organisms. Protein, almost always elevated, but can be normal in viral meningitis. And glucose will only be decreased in the presence of bacteria and fungi because they need the glucose to survive. For everything else, it's going to be normal. And then we briefly talked about Guillain-Barré. It's an immune-mediated polyneuropathy which destroys Schwann cells through molecular mimicry. Main causes will be Campylobacter jejuni or viral infections. Also mycoplasma, but we don't care about that. Symptoms, key symptoms you're going to want to know. Ascending symmetric muscular weakness and neuropathy. And a bonus fact that you need to know is that Guillain-Barré does put you at risk for respiratory failure. And we talked about the specific CSF findings of Guillain-Barré, an elevated protein with a normal white blood cell count, close one. And what will we call that? We would call that albuminocytologic dissociation. All right, and that's all for this episode. Thank you for tuning in to Spoonful of Sugar. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or want to make an episode, please visit our website at spoonfulofsugar.org. Good luck with studying, and remember that if you ever have an SOS moment while studying, Spoonful of Sugar is always here to help the medicine go down.